Welcome to the Creative Shift Podcast. My name is Dan Blank, author of the book Be the Gateway and founder of WeGrowMedia.com. Before we jump into today's episode, just want to let you know that the new session for my four-week program, Social Media for Writers, begins later in February. You can find out everything about the program by going to WeGrowMedia.com and clicking on the Programs tab. There you can find the Social Media for Writers program and everything else I offer for writers. These always include direct feedback from me. Okay, so today's episode, I'm really excited to share my conversation with author Tarue Clavel. So she and I have known each other for a number of years now, and last year she published her first book, World Class One Mother's Journey Halfway Around the Globe in Search of the Best Education for Her Children. Now, this is a book that she lived. It's sort of part memoir and part, you know, nonfiction and advice. She's very big into research. And she spent years living this book and then writing it. It was put out by a major publisher. It was well reviewed by major media. She appeared on Today Show, other TV, lots of radio, I think dozens of podcasts. Plus, I think she's got a blog in Psychology Today. She's active in social media. She's sort of doing all the things that you're told you need to do. In this conversation, she gets radically honest about what is the reality behind the scenes of launching a book. She talks about the rejection, how much rejection is involved, how important the marketing and launch phase is, not just the writing phase. And she gets very specific about what she's done, what she's learned along the way. We also dig really deep into her story. Her life, to me, is just so incredible and inspiring, sort of all the, I guess what I would consider risks, all the places she's lived, all the things that she's done. And it was great to really dig into that with her and also connect it to her ability and desire and drive to create and launch this book. There's so much in this podcast that I think every writer can benefit from in terms of thinking about connecting your life to what you create, but also how you put that out there and what does that work potentially look like for you. All right, I think you're going to love this conversation with Tarue Clavel. Hey everyone, this is Dan Blank. I'm really excited to be chatting with Tarue Clavel. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Dan.
Okay, so we have a lot to cover here, but it's interesting. You have this new book out, and the premise of it is very aligned with what this podcast is about, this idea of making a creative shift. So you have lived in several very, very, very different cultures.
Yes, I have.
Can you give us like just a quick overview from, you know, so many people hate change. They kind of settle in one space and one job and one life, and they resist changing it. For someone who's not lived in these places, can you just give us like a super quick, I've lived here and it looks like that, and we went here and it looks like that, and just kind of an overview for people who might not know the reality of what it's like to live outside of wherever they are.
Sure. So I grew up mostly in the New York City area, and then when I had two kids, my oldest was just under two, still in diapers, we had the opportunity to move to Hong Kong. So that was 2006. And then we were there for 4 years and were in Hong Kong from 2006 till 2010. And then we had the opportunity to go to Shanghai. You wanted me to tell you about
You can do the quick overview.
Like.
That's fine.
Okay. But I will say, so, you know, coming from, I am half Japanese. Japanese is my first language. I very naively kind of thought, oh, well, then I'm totally prepared to raise kids and live in Hong Kong. But that was the biggest takeaway for me, I think, in Hong Kong was, oh my gosh, I don't have the typical support network or the community that I'm used to. And I'm raising kids in this different place. And so I started my parenting journey in a foreign place. And that was a huge wake-up call for me. And then we moved to Shanghai in 2010. At that point, I had three kids, boy, girl. And throughout this whole adventure, by the way, I enrolled my kids in public schools. So that was a whole other layer, not in the typical expat international school setting. We were in Shanghai for 2 years, and that was very shocking because it was the first time I lived in what is kind of called like a developing country or the global South. And it was developing at such a rapid rate, though, that, you know, you get your haircut in a place and the following week you'd go and it wouldn't be there anymore. You would go to the supermarket and you're so excited they got their shipment of ice cream in, and then you take it home and it was half eaten. You'd open your bag of flour that you thought was packaged and it's just full of mealworms. And it was, you know, and then you didn't have regular heat or reliable internet, and Google was shut down. And it's just, it was a very, very different kind of a place to live at the time. So, but at the same time, my kids got a fabulous education, and it's no surprise that they came back years ahead in math, kind of a thing. So we were there for 2 years, and then we moved to Tokyo, which was diametrically opposite of Shanghai. Shanghai at the time was very kind of individualistic, and everybody's, you know, in the Wild West, kind of trying to find their gold rush, because China was developing so quickly. And then we moved to Tokyo and were there for 4 years until 2016. And it's so much more community focused. So everything is about doing selfless deeds for everyone else. And it's not in a way that's like a martyrship. It's just, you think about the collective whole when you are embarking on whatever actions you're taking. So that's why everybody stands in line properly, and children are safe in the streets at the age of 6 years old to be on their own. And so that was a huge change. More for my family, I'm half Japanese, so I was used to that. But then raising my kids in a place like that when we came from Shanghai, and then raising them also in a home that's much more Western than it is Eastern. And then we moved to Palo Alto. We were there in Palo Alto from 2016 to 18. And that was a huge culture shock, and probably surprisingly, the biggest culture shock was coming back home, because we were out of the country for 10 years and the America that we left was very different from the America that we returned to. I mean, when we left, Obama wasn't even elected yet, and we came back and Trump was elected a few months later. And my kids were learning what it was to be American or this typical U.S. citizen in a place that's in the heart of Silicon Valley, but yet the school system was not all that, even though it was supposed to be the quote unquote best school district in the state of California, which has the largest public school system in the nation. And then 2018 finally came home to New York, and have been here since 2 summers ago and have been really happy. And now I have a 15-year-old boy, a 14-year-old boy, and a 10-year-old girl, a high schooler, a middle schooler, and an elementary schooler. And along this journey, I picked up a master's, I became a journalist, and I have a book published with Simon & Schuster imprint Atria. So that's, I guess, in a very big nutshell, what I've been up to for the last 13, 14 years.
So I talk to a lot of writers and a lot of creators, and just even anyone, and you get this type of thing where you're like, oh, what's going on? I'm like, oh my gosh, this week is crazy. You know, my car's in the shop, the brakes need to be done, kid came home from school early, like these sort of these normal things that actually disrupt your day, but they literally disrupt their whole life. So when I think of what you're laughing because you are like this super person.
No, I think it's funny just because yesterday I had to cancel all my meetings because my son, I got a call from his school and his knee went backwards. So I had to take him to the emergency room. And so, yeah, I was just laughing because it's like, yes, yesterday nothing went according to plan, which meant that I had to change everything today, which meant it had the knock on effect, you know? So I was just laughing because, yeah, that's
well, typical. I gave that example because 15 minutes ago, the school nurse called for my son who's okay, but it's like, that's why the example is in
gosh,
my head.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Yep. But for us, it informs our writing and our craft.
Yes. So how do you, like, when you're going through that much transition, it's not just that you move from New York to the suburbs of New York, over to Connecticut, over to Boston, which for a normal person, that would be a lot. Mm. How do you even approach the idea of, wow, we're going to move to Shanghai, we're going to move to Tokyo, we're going to move to Palo Alto? Is there a way that you approach it? Or is there sort of like a, I don't know, I don't think this is the right phrase, but like a thicker skin where you don't worry about it in the way that like I would as a mere mortal. Like you sort of have a system that you go through.
Well, that's an interesting way to look at it. I have to say, it's, you do get a tougher skin, but it's all about your expectations, which people hear all the time. But what I'll add to that is you have these fantasies about what your next step is going to be, right? And that's where people get into trouble, I think. So if you are aware of what that fantasy may be, good or bad, it's like, oh, I'm going to go to this place where there's going to be like dim sum and carts everywhere. You know, it's like, no, it's not like that. Or when you go back to Palo Alto, it's like, oh, we're going back to this country that's not racially divided because we elected our first, you know, African-American president. And like you get the, oh, we're going to the best school district in California, so it's going to be amazing. And then, you know, the higher your expectations are and these fantasies exist, the more you're likely to crumble because they're fantasies. Nothing is perfect. And so I think when you unravel all of that, then you're kind of ready for anything. And I think it's a better way to be. And it took a long time to get to that point. So here's a classic example. We were flying back from Shanghai because when we lived in Tokyo, we would go back to Shanghai so the kids wouldn't forget their Mandarin quite frequently. So we were coming back, and my kids are trilingual. They speak English, Japanese, and Mandarin. And on the loudspeaker on our flight back from Shanghai, an announcement was made. And my Mandarin is so not good. Why don't I put it that way? Where, you know, my kids are fluent. And my oldest looks at me and he says, Mama, Mama, maybe he's 9 or 10 years old. He says, We're not going to Tokyo. I go, yeah. I mean, I just kind of thought he misunderstood. Maybe his Mandarin isn't that good. And then we land, because they only made the announcement in Mandarin. We land, and then I hear all these Japanese speakers get on their phones, because I do speak Japanese, and they're all saying, you know, very politely to whomever they're speaking with, it doesn't look like we're in Tokyo. We're not quite sure where we are. But to make a long story short, we did an emergency landing in the middle of the night, not in Tokyo. We had to get bused 3 hours to go to some country inn that could accommodate an airplane full of passengers. We had to wake up 3 hours later at like 5 or 6 in the morning to get on another plane to go back. I mean, it was hilarious. And that's what I think about. And I think most people be like, oh my gosh, you had 3 kids under, you know, 8 or 9 years old. There's a screaming baby in every part of that. And all I can think about was how absolutely hilarious it was. And I kept taking pictures of it and like thinking it was, because I think most people would have been tearing their hair out. And, you know, we didn't get our luggage. We didn't, I mean, the whole thing was just the four of us were piled up into one bed. I mean, it was like, but you can only laugh at things like that. And I think that's the thicker skin. It's like you just get prepared for anything. And then you also realize in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter. That just doesn't matter at all. It's just, you have to just think it adds color to your life.
So funny. This is such a point that I think encapsulates so much of, you know, you have this perspective because you have lived in different places and experienced that, because you've told me stories in the past about what it's like, you know, in Japan or what it was like in China. And even in Palo Alto, how different it was, because I think of Palo Alto, I think of, oh, that's where Steve Jobs used to live and his house was here. Mm. And like this sort of real perception. But when you're living there, it's a very different thing because, well, I don't know why. There's power dynamics, there's expectations, there's haves and haves nots, there's people want to leg up, there's all these different things.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. All of that. all of it. And yeah, sorry, I cut you off. But it's true. It's like you think, oh, if Steve Jobs and Mark Zuckerberg and Sergey Brin and, you know, the list goes on and on, Tim Cook live within a few miles, then yeah, the schools must be great and it must be beautiful and everything must be functioning. But, you know, the reality, and Stanford's right there, right? Stanford University, and there are palm trees, you know? And so you think, it's going to be just the most heavenly place ever. But then think about this. It's, while it is very diverse in terms of people from all over the world come there, everybody's focused on making money and computer coding, right? Which doesn't add for a lot of diversity of interest or much cultural, you know, cultural diversity or interests. And that was something that was really hard for me, having been in kind of these cultural meccas, New York, Hong Kong, Shanghai, Tokyo, where, you know, there's like a Lincoln Center in your backyard everywhere I was. And then people think, oh, well, Palo Alto is so close to San Francisco. But because there is so much growth, on a Friday night, it could easily take you 2 hours to get into San Francisco, which without traffic should take 35 or 40 minutes. You know, so yeah, you may be able to dream about going to a concert in San Francisco, but that's as far as it goes, because it's kind of crazy to think that you're going to drive 4 hours to go into the city and come back in an evening.
Now compare that. I remember when you were telling me when you first moved to China.
Yeah.
Like that first, I think it was like the first week. You have a story with that? I was trying to remember. I remember there's something where it was like, you know, the whole place wasn't finished, or things that you'd normally would think would be there operate are like, they're not operating.
You gave when we moved to Shanghai, we decided to live locally. So we lived in an ex-communist tenement. And when we did our walkthrough before we signed the lease agreement, you know, everything looked really shiny on the outside. And this was another, you know, welcome to China moment for me, because, you know, I signed the paperwork and I was like, ha ha, happy. Yes, great. Yeah, we're going to move in. And then the next day I went, and I don't know how this happens. Maybe someone who understands the inside of refrigerators and mold can explain this to me, but like the inside of the refrigerator was black. It was like they did some kind of a Emperor's New Clothes kind of thing. And then the cabinets inside were just, they'd like fallen. It was like a last minute, like someone decided to put like a toothpick in there to hold up the shelves or something. It was, and there were cockroaches literally eating the wood, and it must've been, or like they were congregating there. I don't know if they were like ensconced in food and oil and stuff you couldn't see. And then, you know, by the time we moved in, nothing was reliable. I mean, there were so many evenings when the kids' bathtub was on the second floor and I would be boiling, you know, pans and pots of hot water on our stove on the first floor and carrying them upstairs to fill up our bathtub because we didn't have hot water. And the floor is splintered constantly. And little kids run around barefoot. Like, you can make them put shoes on, but they're going to come off. So the number of evenings I would be like pulling splinters out of all, it's multiple splinters out of their feet. I mean, it was, and if I wanted, you know, I want a taste of the U.S. and I'd want to watch Grey's Anatomy, and you would have to watch to make sure the Wi-Fi was connected and wasn't breaking down. And it would literally take 2 to 3 days to download one episode of Grey's Anatomy. You know, and just there's so many stories like that, that it just, but it humbles you. And that was one of the reasons I felt like I needed to go to Shanghai, was because I never really appreciated the luxury I had of depending on any system to work. I always took it for granted. You know, you have a traffic light and people are going to abide by it. I mean, in Shanghai, the number of times people just run red lights and you're literally running to try to get to the other side because you see a car is not going to stop and you're holding your children's hands. I mean, or their car's driving on the sidewalk. You know, and this is, you know, 10 years ago, so things have changed, but that kind of an experience makes you alert, aware, you know, grateful. And it was great for the kids to get that exposure. I mean, that may sound like an odd thing to say, but they saw that there are people who are literally hungry and really hungry to get out of that state. So they're fiercely competitive.
And you had talked about how the education there, though, was incredible.
It was incredible. I mean, my son in first grade, there wasn't running water in his bathrooms. There weren't doors on his bathrooms. There was literally no technology in the classroom other than the light switch kind of a thing. And the teachers were so dedicated. Starting in first grade, they were subject specific. So he had a separate math teacher from his language teacher, from science and English. And these teachers would stay after school with the kids for as long as it took for them to master the content. And one day he didn't get a 95 on a math quiz, and the teacher kept him after school. And they didn't just go over the content that was on that quiz, but gave him more challenging material to make sure he understood the content and that he could apply it and really had mastered that. And sometimes the kids would stay through dinner and the teachers would stay with them for as long as it took. And you think about that, right? If you can't master basic arithmetic in first grade, right, you're not going to be able to do algebra or algebra 2, trig, precalculus, calculus, multivariable calculus. And we wonder these, you know, I don't wonder, but a lot of people in this country wonder why our math skills are so low. And when we look at our graduate programs in this country, why there's such an influx of students from Asia, primarily India, China, and South Korea. And it's not a mystery to me, because when I was in China, they drill down on the basics and the mechanics, and then they apply that so that the kids really understand it. And so a classic example, yeah.
Interesting, because I also take a view of this from the creative side, because a lot of this is like, my podcast is not education, but I'm thinking of this as one master's a craft. Because what I'm hearing also, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's not just that your kids are being, oh, they're working 12 hours a day, they're drilling, drilling, drilling. What it sounds like from your tone is that, no, Dan, there's a community here. Teachers show up and they care. They care if the student understands. And when they give him another drill, it's not throwing a textbook. They're kind of working with him or her. And that it's actually, it's almost like I would view like an apprenticeship. It's how you get good at something. Yeah, there's more hours, there's more effort, but it's not just like you're locked away in a room. There's this whole community of caring and of thoughtfulness and of togetherness, where it doesn't sound like your kid came home like drawn and exhausted saying, my gosh, this is horrible.
No, that's such a good point. He didn't. And he would even say today, math is one of his favorite subjects. And he says the belief that the teachers had in him are what kept motivating him. Oh, and wow. It requires discipline. And when you get that discipline so early in life, right, it's a habit. That's a wonderful habit that sets the routine. And as we all know, breaking a bad habit later in life can take years and so much effort. Whereas when you instill it early, it becomes, you don't even think about it, you know? And it's interesting that you talked about the word community, because that's exactly right. Everybody helps everybody else that way. Kids are partnered with other kids in the classroom, and there's no labeling, oh, he's good at this, he's not good at that, that's why they're getting, no, you just, everybody helps everybody else out. And everybody's expected to meet that high expectation. And it maybe takes some kids longer and it takes other strategies, but everybody's going to get there. There's no exception to that. And something that's interesting is the competition. There's a study that recently came out across 79 different economies and countries on the PISA exam. And while it does test for academics for 15-year-olds, and yes, China is head and shoulders above everybody else and almost 4 years ahead of our 15-year-olds in math, that's a whole other conversation. But it showed, and these are two things that are really kind of scary, is that our students feel like their school is much more competitive than it is collaborative. And students in China and Japan, for example, find it much more collaborative than competitive. And here we have these presumptions about what goes on there, that they're being abused because they're so disciplined and they don't have any fun. And it's the opposite. They feel supported by their communities. And the other thing is, our students comparatively have a much lower positive mindset than those in East Asia and even in the Scandinavian countries. So basically, it doesn't matter what your socioeconomic background is, they have a belief system that, yeah, if I do well in school, I'm going to do really well in life. Whereas here, those kids who are socioeconomically disadvantaged feel like they're going to stay that way. It doesn't matter what kind of effort they put in.
Funny, because I again, bring this back to the idea of like creative success, someone who wants to write a book or have a career that's creative, there's this idea of achievement. And we see it online now on Instagram and social media, and we see the articles because there's so many places to publish. Oh, here's my case story. How became a bestseller.
Yeah.
But it often creates this horrible self-doubt, all these negative things. So it's interesting to hear you talk about how that discipline and that thing was about finding different ways of support. And achievement is a part of this community. So you've told different stories about...
I agree with you.
You've told
I was just saying, I agree. I think I found.
I think there was a
delay. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I think there was a delay.
I think there was too.
So you told stories about how it was different in Japan, and you hinted at it here, this idea of you could just let your 6-year-old go to school, walk to school in the street. Can you just give me a sense of that difference? Because that too, I think, is challenging and interesting in a wholly different fashion.
Yeah, and I think hearing about it from a U.S. perspective can be really, really jarring, because thinking about sending your, you know, 6-year-old to school on his or her own, which could include just a walk that's maybe just 100 feet away, but it can also include a commute one way that's over an hour that includes literally trains, buses, and walking. And if anybody's seen any of those videos or experienced firsthand what it's like to be in a train station in Japan during rush hour, I mean, you can literally be levitated. There's so many people. But what ends up happening is, starting at such a young age, whether the child starts schooling at preschool or in elementary school, because compulsory education starts in first grade in Japan, kids are taught to not only be very self-sufficient at a very young age, they are told never pack a child's bag for them, never organize for them, that kind of stuff. But then, starting in first grade, kids have chores in the classroom. So there's no janitors, there's no cafeteria workers. Kids are, like, they take a pencil and pens and markers and scissors to school in their pencil case. They also are required to take a rag. And they clean the floors, they clean the toilets, the blackboard. There are no cafeteria workers, so they get the food on the cart, serve their classmates, sit family style, clean up after themselves, and the kids are required to eat everything they are served. You know, and so it creates this whole, I'm looking out for the bigger picture, and that transcends into the larger community. Because when you're taught that at such a young age, already in the streets, everybody's looking out for the young kids. So in first grade, the kids have what they have, like a yellow flap on the back of their backpacks, and they all wear yellow hats. And when they get older, they become navy in the winter and white in the summer in elementary school. But the first graders wear yellow. And it's bright yellow. And, you know, from a U.S. perspective, it's, oh, my gosh, these little six-year-olds have a target on their back. Someone's going to come kidnap them and hurt them because they're only 6 years old. Whereas in Japan, it's no. Everybody's looking out for these six-year-olds to make sure they get everywhere safely. They cross the street. They know in the rain they should hold their umbrellas and not just jump in the puddles, because it's the society's responsibility to make sure these kids are self-sufficient and can take care of themselves, so one day they can be contributing members of this greater society.
Being from New York and now being back in New York,
yeah,
I have to imagine it's slightly different what you're experiencing now.
It is different. And even in Palo Alto, I mean, you know, I went to my daughter when we first got there was in second grade and my son was in fifth, my two younger kids. And I went to the school one day and this mom came up to me and she said, Taru, how are you? I never see you here. And I looked at her like, why would I be here? Is there a problem? She goes, because you never come to drop off and pick up. And I was like, why should I? She bikes to school on her own. It's like 5 blocks and my son bikes with her. Like, what? Why should I show up? And to me, I looked at it so differently because I'd been socialized to parent in Japan. And if I can give my kids the autonomy and they can handle it, why would I take it away from them? So, you know, it was so interesting to me that was her take on it. She probably thought I was like worst parent of the year. And I thought I was getting
such an interesting thing, because I think of this as, yes, as a parent, but also as just someone who's trying to fit in art and writing in an otherwise busy life, is there's so many things you feel you have to do to mm-hmm. be good or good mm-hmm. enough. And that's a good example. Well, if I'm not showing up every day at my kid's school like so-and-so is, then I'm a bad parent. Mm-hmm. So then you're not creating, because you're, as you say, you're not valuing their independence, you're judging. And it creates this horrible cycle where you're failing at everything, but not really pursuing what you want to be doing, which is where a lot of people land. It's really unfortunate because they just don't feel good about anything.
Well, I'll add to that, which I feel like it was self-preservation. The more my kids could do, the less they needed me. And I thought it was like a win-win, because if I was around my kids all the time and doing everything for them, I was like, when would I have time to write? When would I have time, you know? And when I was in Japan, especially, I was a journalist and I had to make sure I could do all my interviews while the kids were away, you know? And so when I got back to Palo Alto, and even though I let my kids go to get to and from school on their own, I did feel like, well, I was in the suburbs, right? So it required a lot of drive time. And suddenly so much of my time was taken away from me. And it was a shock. It was a shock to my system.
Because you're stuck in a car.
Yeah. And my kid, well, I mean, I had my whole computer set up and everything. So that was when my son was doing soccer, I'd sit in the parking lot and start writing on my laptop. But at the same time, I felt like suddenly I lost hours of my day.
I think of how, like I said before, people try to, they try to do everything. Well, I should be a good parent. I should be good at my job. I want to create. I should do CrossFit. I should, like, it's all these things. And we're all sort of, again, sort of feeling guilty about all of it. But the other ways of maybe education you're talking about, it sounds like people are going all in with some very specific things. They're not trying to kind of balance everything. They're saying, one, they're finding a way that they feel works, but there's a level of like intensity to it, or maybe it's clarity. Is that a way to describe these other methods of living, as whether it's a culture or education, that sort of thing?
It's a good question. I feel like, I mean, the U.S. is really, really hard because there's just so many options. You know, even with schooling, it's like, you know, when you think about educating your child, it's not just parochial, public, private, charter, homeschooling. It's even once you make those decisions, and even if you can, you know, drill it down to that, there's so many choices within those choices, you know, and that's just one example of choice. And something my mother said, and she was born right after World War II ended in Japan, and it was a baby boom time. And she always told me growing up, she's like, I feel so badly for you. You have too many choices. I had no choices. You know, you ate what you were told to eat, and you read what you were told to read, because maybe that was the only book that was available. And so I do feel like it can be suffocating in some ways to be able to navigate that and to be able to drill down and, you know, get rid of that noise. And you know, and this is something I have to remind myself of all the time. As you know, being on the creative side, it's crazy competitive. And there's always someone who looks like they're doing better than you, especially in the day of Instagram and social media. You're like, oh my gosh, how did that happen? And why am I so bad? And why couldn't I say that? And this is wrong, but what do I do about it? Nobody cares what I have to say. I mean, these are things that go through, I think, any creative person's mind all the time. And I think it's just a matter of prioritizing, know you're on your right path, setting your goals, having your mission. And the kind of logical side is the efficiency. You have to be so efficient. I have three kids. And like I just mentioned earlier, you know, one of them blew out his knee yesterday and there was 4 hours at the emergency room. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, okay. So that throws a huge kink into things. And so it's a matter of prioritization, I guess. And it's something I struggle with. I'm not going to say I'm a master of that, but it's every day reminding myself that, okay, I'm not going to be on tech right now. I'm with my children. Or yes, I'm intentionally going to watch this really, really junky TV show with my kids because it's our time for brain relaxation. Or I'm going to sit through another animated, you know, Pixar film for the 20th time. It's like, but it's a matter of saying no to stuff and filtering out the noise. And it's really hard to do.
So amidst all of these different transitions, so the, you know, the kids in these different, you know, different cultures, different things, you're moving, several years, although it's a different thing. You mentioned like, oh, I got my master's, I became a journalist. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to me a bit about those processes? I'm not exactly sure where to begin with that, but that idea of outside of these incredible transitions, these responsibilities, all of that, that you're also finding this thing that you want to do that, as you mentioned before, it requires so much time, so much focus. How did you start with that process? Was it first, I got my master's and it led into this, or was it vice versa?
Well, I think everybody has some kind of a catalyst for change, small or monumental. And we came back in the summers, and the summer of 2011, we always did all our medical checkups. We had doctors where we lived overseas, and then we did our annuals in the U.S. And I had a health scare, and it was at the very end of the summer of 2011 before we were going back to Shanghai. And I'm not going to minimize, the first year in Shanghai was really, really hard. And I talk about this in my book World Class. It was, you know, my kids were doing phenomenally well, I felt like, but I was suffering. And when you have kids, for the most part, you put on a happy face. And even though you're wearing pajamas under your coat or you're like miserable inside, you know, you'll do almost anything for your kids. And I don't want to say I felt sorry for myself, because I don't feel like I had a choice to do that, but I wasn't in a happy place. And so when I had the health scare, everything turned out to be all right ultimately. But I thought, okay, so my daughter is now 2 years old. She's going into a pre-K program that is several hours long every day. I got to do something with my life. And that's when I literally looked online and found the Drexel University online program in comparative and international education and to get a master's in that. And I always was fascinated by education. My kids did attend local public schools at that point in two different cities, Hong Kong and now Shanghai. And I'm half Japanese. I went to school in the summers in Japan. So I thought, okay, this is great because I never wanted to be, or I didn't think I was good at being a teacher, a classroom teacher, but I love education, education policy. So I sign up for this thing thinking it's like, I don't even know if it still exists. Sorry, but Gotham Writers Workshop, is that even still out there?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So I was a person who would take tons of those classes all the time. And I thought, oh, this program's going to be like Gotham Writers Workshop. Like I'll write a page a week or maybe I'll... No, this program was so hard. It's a master's program. So it kicked my butt into gear. And when you go back to school later in life, right, and you're doing it on your own, and anytime you're not with your children, like I was doing that, and anytime I took away from my children, it had to be for something that was really worth it. So I rolled up my sleeves, was in this program for 2.5 years. And if there were like 5 articles on a topic that were assigned in 2 days or something like that, I'd read 50. And I'm not exaggerating. I just completely immersed myself into this world. And because it was online, I was able to move from Shanghai to Tokyo, and it was on my own watch, right? So I could do the work when I wanted to. I mean, they were in quarters. But in the midst of it, we moved to Tokyo. And before, during any transition we had, I always took time off from anything I was doing for 6 months. That was my window to get my kids adjusted.
Let's pause on one thing, because
you
made this point, and this is something I think about a lot, which is like, fitness is always an easy example. Oh, I want to get a workout routine. I don't have one. So you struggle to find 3 days a week to get 40 minutes in.
Mm-hmm.
Then you talk to your neighbor and they work out 7 days a week in the morning, but at night, 2 days a week, they do basketball. And the other night they're in a soccer league. And it's like a scale that's like beyond, and you both work the same full-time job, blah, blah, blah. Is there something there when you say you immersed yourself in that? Like, and this is like, I don't even know what the question is, but it's the idea of like, how do you find the time? What is it that happens with an immersion versus, yeah, I'm in the program and I'm keeping up pretty good versus I'm in it. Like I am totally immersed in this.
I kind of felt like my survival depended on it. You know, I had this opportunity. I was overseas. I didn't know anybody who was kind of doing what I was doing, putting my kids in different public schools, and they were young enough to be, and they were thriving. And I wasn't happy until that point. And I needed, there was no life raft that was going to save me other than me. So this I needed to do. And then how do you do it? You know, there weren't going to be any more 2-hour lunches. You know, it was going to be, I have 55 minutes and that's it. It's going to be, I can't go to the restaurant because that service is slow. It's, I'm not going to muck around on, at the time I didn't really have YouTube, but you know, things that you may waste your time on that become really easy to just like get in the sinkhole on, that just falls away. And then you prioritize your friendships as well. You know, as much as I'd like to meet a ton of people all the time, you suddenly kind of have tiers, you know, and it's like, I can't meet fifth tier friend today because I have work to do. And then you start saying, okay, but I can meet a lot of people at one time. So you have a group lunch instead or a group dinner. And you just become much more efficient with your time because you just have to, because I prioritized my studies. And good friends understand that and support you anyway. So that's pretty much what I did. And I think... I needed to do it. There was no choice, like literally no choice. I needed to do it and I needed to get straight A's. So that's another side of it. And that was it. There was no conversation about it. Like, and when I graduated from the program, I mean, this may be painting a really bad picture of who I am, but I went, I talked to the assistant who was running the department, and I said, so do I get an award for having a 4.0? She's like, this is grad school. It doesn't really matter. And I was like, well, what do you mean? I worked really, really hard. And it was kind of funny. And I did get an award just for my research and things like that. But it wasn't because I was like valedictorian of my, you know, yeah. And it was because, but the bottom line is I did it for me. So it didn't, that didn't matter. But at that point too, I needed to prove to myself that I still had it because for the most part, I'd been a trailing spouse. I'd given up my career that I had prior to having children. And I needed to prove I had the brain power and the capacity to really excel and master something. It was just, it was very important that I did it for myself. Yeah.
And from there you went into journalism.
Yeah. So what ended up happening was because I was doing, I was in Tokyo when I was finishing up my master's and I was waiting for, kind of, I guess it's like thesis approval from the government because when you do research on kids, then you need all these other kinds of approvals. And there, it was more, a little more complicated because my research was being done in Japanese and my paper was being written in English. And my paper, I mean, it was multiple hundreds of pages document. So there was this like bureaucratic red tape that was taking time and I wasn't used to not having anything to do. So I had like a 1 or 2 month window where I was basically twiddling my thumbs and I was getting just really upset about kind of the news I was reading about education and stuff like that. So I said, I'm just going to start writing. So I started writing articles and sending them off. And of course, like everything got rejected and I was like, oh, but I worked so hard on it. And then one of the outlets came back to me and said, do you have anything else? Like, this is all wrong, but do you have anything else? So I didn't even know what it meant to pitch, what it meant to be a freelance journalist. I just was trying to basically killing time. So I immediately, I got this email within 5 minutes. I said, yes, these are the three things that I've been thinking about. And they just wrote back to me. It was the Japan Times. And the editor wrote back to me and said, go with this one. And we want it in 2 weeks. And I was like, oh, that's how this works. And I didn't even know that's what, and I was just like, okay, great. I have something to do. I was just thankful.
That's really how incredible it started. Though. Cause I talk to writers all the time. Some are pitching and again, we get all into the imposter syndrome and the like,
oh yeah.
I had this conversation with someone the other day who's just brilliant, you know, but it was a thing of like, do I wait until the morning to send it? Do I wait till the week after the new year? Because we have all this, these questions and they sound logical. But they're mm-hmm. sometimes delaying things.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just so interesting that you're like, I just started writing. I just started sending it out, which I imagine was probably somewhat haphazardly, but then that's also how you find a way in, which is what happened to you.
Like, oh, yeah, I mean, I don't want to, when was it? It was 2013. That's when it was, the fall of 2013. And at the time, I mean, every rejection hurt. I mean, there's no question. There were, because I sent, you know, to the New York Times, and at the time I'm so naive, I'm like, oh, you just send it and maybe it'll get published. No, that's not the way it works at all. But I kind of didn't have all my eggs in one basket, and I was lucky something came through, and I was really lucky. And I think what I learned from that is my mom has this ridiculous saying. Well, it's ridiculous only because of the imagery, but she says, time to take the cookie when they pass the tray. You know, and it's basically when the opportunity arises, you have to grab it because it may only come up once kind of a thing. And so once I got that article and then I started talking to friends who are journalists, I was like, what do I do? What do I do? They're like, a few rules. Get in good with your editor. Get a good relationship. Be friends with them. Go to lunch with them. And then find out what they're looking for and always pitch, pitch, pitch. Before you finish your next article, pitch another article. Keep the relationship strong. And so that's what I did. I started just networking and learning how it was done. So at that point, I don't know how many articles I ended up writing for the Japan Times. And that morphed into getting my name out there and people coming to me and asking me to write for them. And then I got pieces in the Financial Times. And then CBS This Morning called and, you know, initially I'm like, who do they want? You know, or Squawk Box on CNBC. But it all kind of came together because I felt like I had nothing to lose, frankly. Wow. You know, I mean, it's like, yeah, my pride was hurt, but I mean, to be totally honest, nothing hurts your pride, I think, more than writing a book, because I mean, you have to have a really thick skin because you're being criticized on every social media platform and email. And, you know, I mean, that hurts, because writing a book is really blood, sweat, and tears. So now I look back at kind of the rejection I faced in journalism, or kind of the hate mail I got, and I'm like, yeah, that made me tougher for what was to come.
So what is it about a book? So I have to imagine it's because it clearly takes a lot longer to write research, edit the book, get a book deal, get to publication. You're so proud of it. It's the whole of what you think on a topic. Is that part of the setup of that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's exhausting. And I'm one of those people. I'm a crazy editor. A lot of people don't like editing. I actually love the editing process, because I feel like when all the pieces of the puzzle come together, it looks so beautiful. And I love chopping things. Like I love making things as concise as possible. And then you get to play with like the tricks, the words, the italics, the grammar, the dialogue. It's the tinkering. I really love that stuff. You know, and it's exhausting. And then I had a 2-year period. So once I sold the book idea, it was off a book proposal, and then they gave me a year to write the book, and then I had a year before it was out. So that's too long. Like, I don't know, 2 years. I mean, imagine being pregnant for 2 years. I mean, there's no way your expectations aren't going to be inflated, you know? And I'm a first-time author, so I had all kinds of crazy notions about what I thought was going to happen. And the reality is, your book comes out, and I'm not famous, you know, so who's really paying attention to it? Sorry, my dog is barking. Is that?
Can't even hear the dog.
Oh, good. Okay. You know, so I had all these expectations, and I'd done the audio of my book as well. And that required me to be in the studio for 30 hours before the book came out. So of course, like, I'm thinking, oh my God, this is like winning an Academy Award, and it's nothing close. I mean, it's like I describe it as a pine cone falling in the snow in winter. It was like nobody paid attention, because you're the one who has to create all the drama for the book. So that's when the real work starts, in my opinion. And it's just really hard. And I don't know, you know, if you've had guests who talk about it, but literally within a few months of my book coming out, my editor left my imprint, my publicist left my publishing house, my agent quit her agency. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm completely on my own. And that's the reality, you know? And that wasn't part of my fantasy, you know? So it's kind of like, especially in today's really hard to penetrate media cycles, it's all me. It's like sink or swim. So if I'm not putting it out there, you know, I don't know who else is. And someone told me just, I think it was yesterday, the day before, the best thing you can do is to drop breadcrumbs everywhere, because you never know what's going to hit in the social media cycle, in the media cycle that you drop, because, you know, everything is everlasting, right? These days that you put out there.
I love how you, instead of using the word marketing is up to you, to create marketing, you said create drama. That was a great way to describe it.
It is, but it's like, it's crazy, you know? And there's some people who don't have any issue with putting their lives out there and being very, very public about almost every single thing, everything they do. And I struggle with that. And it's maybe ironic, because my book is, you know, 50% memoir, but it's selected memoir. It's not like I'm talking about every single detail of every single aspect of my life. But once you put it out there, people kind of expect you to be completely transparent. So I struggle with this boundary and this limitation of what's public and what's private, especially in this world, right, where being very public gets you a lot of publicity.
Yeah, it's been neat for me to watch you become more public. And I've seen you really share a lot more over the years, and that's really interesting. But like you said, when I look at it too, I also look at what is she not sharing, where are the boundaries? And I think that's a very smart thing for anyone to do, is to be really clear about what will I share, how often, and then what won't I share. And it seems like you've made those decisions.
I try, but it's really, really hard. And just to give an idea, so I went I went to a summer program, summer after junior year of high school, and my roommate, Amy, she's this amazing girl that came from a town that was 1 square mile in Kansas, and I came from New York, so we were like day and night, but we were very, very close, and when I told her I was writing this book, she goes, "Are you crazy? You are the most private person I know," you know, and it was like, yeah, I'm doing this, and it's interesting that the twists and turns, but I really believed in kind of the concept and the mission and the story that I felt like I had a social responsibility to tell parents and educators in this country. So that's what drove my putting myself out there.
So you come to that realization, and I know you prepared for this as well, but you come to that point of saying, oh, this is on me. What have you been doing to get this book out there? Because it's been neat for me to kind of watch from, you know, kind of afar to see the workshops and the press, like, how have you approached that? What actions have you taken to get it out?
Oh, that's such a good question. And I am not a seasoned hand at this whatsoever, so I will probably sound like a complete hack. But I was told to hire an outside publicist by my agent. So I did, and a lot of people today, I have friends who are authors, and you probably heard it, they will hire a publicist and get zero traction. Literally zero. And some of my friends are journalists for major, major media outlets, and they still got zero response. And I got a few things from it, but it was definitely, I felt like the return on investment at the time was, it was like, you know, authors don't make a lot of money. So to me, it was so excruciatingly painful, and it's a limited time that they do the, at least the publicist I hired was on a short time frame, and so it was like, okay, what do I do? And you know, it's very easy, I think what you mentioned earlier, you know, people, you see people's successes online and they get competitive and then you have imposter syndrome, I mean, all those things I felt. And sometimes I was like, oh my gosh, like they got this amazing article in the Washington Post or New York Times, and why couldn't I be interviewed, or how do I get out there and what do I do? And the reality is, it's like someone told me recently, it's like the swan who looks so beautiful on the surface, but their legs are hysterically flapping like they're, you know, underwater. And that's what I think it really is, because, you know, I was on CNN on Fareed Zakaria's GPS, and that was my dream interview. I said, literally, before I die, I want to be on that show. So the fact that that even came through was like ridiculously amazing for me. But, you know, for that one success, there were hundreds of pitches that where I got rejected.
And are you saying that these are pitches that now you've been making?
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, this week alone, I counted, I think I have 8 interviews on podcasts and radio and such, but there are dozens of rejections that come for just one 10-minute interview.
So those are interviews that you found these places, you sent the pitch. So the 8 of them all came from you doing that legwork. And then on top of that are the, I'll make up a number, 40 that you pitched as well that didn't go through.
Well, see, so, okay, so this I will tell you. So I started working with a radio agent. And what you end up doing is, once you find someone, and they, you know, they're on limited contracts too, you can learn the ropes. And then you can take it over. So that's kind of, that's what's been going on. So it's been like a horrifically, I have to admit, painful learning curve, and costly, because I've made mistakes financially as well. And you know, you work with someone and it doesn't work out, and you're like, oh, because you're literally, I mean, I'm like counting my pennies, maybe it's dollars at this point, but you know, and so I think about, what's the return on investment for all of this? Because you balance, you prioritize. I have 3 kids. I'm working on my next book, and writing requires you to go into a cave. You can't just say, okay, I have a 10-minute. And when you're doing radio, literally. So I had this interview with Dr. Drew, and it came in 2 hours before I was going live. And, you know, you suddenly, it's like, oh, it's, well, Dr. Drew Pinsky. It's like, he's Dr. Drew. We grew up on Dr. Drew. You have to say yes to Dr. Drew. But then suddenly, everything is in upheaval, because it wasn't plan for. So then you have to prep, you have to reschedule everything. I had to pull over on the side of a street because I was driving. It was like a 6-hour drive, and you have to make sure you have good Wi-Fi connection. I mean, there's another time I did another radio station. Oh, it was horrible, Dan. And it was supposed to be live on WTOP in Washington, D.C. I couldn't get the connection. The woman is screaming at me. And I was like, I don't know what to do. I'm in the middle of the Bronx. Like, I'm in a car and there's bumper to bumper traffic, and I'm trying to like get Wi-Fi through the Dunkin' Donuts. I was like, this, I mean, it's like, it's, you know, this is the craziness that people don't necessarily see, because all they may hear is, oh, isn't it lovely? Tarou published a book and it's out there on Bookshop. It's like, no. Like, I often make the joke that I should be in Times Square with a naked cowboy, you know, asking people to buy my book. You know, it's, and then, yeah, and I do, after my last library talk, where I think there were 15 or 20 people there, I'm like, I'm not doing this again, because it's just not worth my time to go out there, talk, and then maybe sell 10 or 15 books and come back. And those are good numbers, you know? And so I've just come to the point where, and I've learned, the learning curve has been super steep for me. So I did go to a writer's conference the summer of 2014. And it was, I think, Writer's Digest in New York City. And there was a keynote speaker who said something, and I hope I'm allowed to use one expletive. You can bleep it out if you need to. But he gets up there and he said, just remember, there are no assholes in writing. No one's an asshole. Everybody's nice. And I get it now, because there is so much rejection that if you are not empathetic to fellow creatives and artists, then you don't belong in this field, because it's really, really hard.
It's been great to kind of see how you've done this. When I've seen photos of you doing a library talk, or, you know, doing a thing that looked like in your home with people there, you being in the shows, I'm so aware of like how much she must have done to get there. And then you're trying to think of the ROI on that, as you're saying, you're thinking, what will you do next? And there's so many options with that too. So it's interesting to take on it. But of course, what's great too is that you're saying you're building these skills and you're writing the next book, which I love.
Yeah. I think that's like this double-edged sword where, well, it really is like, and I'm sure you've had plenty of people say this, it's like having a baby. After you have the baby, you're like, I'm never doing this again. And then there comes this time when you're like, wait a minute, I have another one in me, you know? And over this holiday, it was the first time I can remember where I took, I'm not going to say 2 solid weeks off, because I was working, but I hadn't had that much downtime in, I honestly cannot remember. Like, I can't, years. And, you know, that's really, really important, because that's a downtime you need to process things, to mull over, to reconsider where you are. And I got all these ideas for another narrative nonfiction book. And I'm just mulling it over and talking, and I'm going to talk through it with a few more people. But I do have a kids series that I'm writing right now, so that I'm really excited about. That's definitely happening. But I thought I was going to be scarred by the narrative nonfiction genre for the rest of my life. But I may have another one in me. I'm not quite sure. But I'm excited about the idea, which I just definitely did not think was ever going to happen.
So I have to ask about this, because I mentioned before, like, you have, like, you had this like competitive tennis hobby career at some point. And I feel like it's related, because some point over the holidays, you post this video of you and a friend doing this incredibly choreographed dance routine. And it was, you know, it was like 2 minutes or so. You're clearly having a blast. And like, my jaw's on the floor, because what I'm looking at is this skill that I had no idea you knew anything about dance. I had no idea you were doing that. And you had somehow decided, I want to do this. I want to do it with my friend. And what is that? Because that's something that to me is so embodies who you are, is this idea of like, you don't do anything halfway. And you do this thing that like, it's just so, it's not left of center. I just didn't know. What's the story with that? Because I think that that's the similar place that we come to of like, I'm going to write a novel, I'm going to start a business. What is that dance thing?
Okay, so the dance thing, you know, people always ask you, and I feel like it's this thing in our society right now where it's, you know, me time, or what are you doing for yourself? And I'm always looking at people when they ask me, like, what? Like, what? Me time. I have three kids. I'm writing books. I'm doing publicity. When I have me time, I'm watching The Bachelor. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know what that means. And I thought, you know, there are things that I've definitely wanted to do. And life is definitely not getting longer. And I may be on the second half more than my first half of life at this point. So I started thinking about what is that? And I've always loved dancing. I've loved hip hop dancing. And finally, I was like, you know what? I'm going to take some hip hop classes. And I said, I'm just going to do it. And then I happened to have told a girlfriend of mine. She's like, oh my gosh, I've been wanting to do that too. When are you doing it? So that she and I were like, okay, we're totally going to do this together. And then we're very like goal oriented because we thought we wouldn't take it seriously if we didn't have a goal. So we're like, okay, we are going to come up with a video and we are going to post this so that we are held accountable to doing this. And I'm like, oh my gosh, it's perfect. It's Christmas. We're going to do it. And our goal was to literally bring joy to people, because if we can make complete jerks of ourselves doing something so inane, then maybe other people will feel empowered to do the same and just let loose, you know, because we're not perfect. I mean, we're far from perfect in the video, and we could just laugh about it. So I kind of felt like, okay, put it out there, because also my girlfriend was like, oh my gosh, you're going to ruin your serious reputation if you post that stuff. And I was like, no, I think it's important that I do that actually, because I don't want people to think that everything is just perfect or that I can't let loose, or, you know, I'm like a ticking time bomb of trying to get publicity. So I think it's important. So we're continuing that. And this month, our theme is flash dance. And we're not sure if we're going to do the leg warmers and the leotard with the belt, but we're thinking about it. And so, yeah, this is our little project. And I think it's important that we all, if we can, you know, when you find that thing that's worth making time for, that we try to do it. But it wasn't easy. I mean, I think people have been asking me what I do for me since I stopped playing tennis 10 years ago.
So funny, because it's so neat to hear that you had that purpose with it, because like I said, I saw it and I was like, this was so much work. I can't imagine how you found the time and the energy, all that. And to hear that there's this purpose behind it too, it's like, it's how I took it. So great to see. I mean, it's totally inspiring to me. It's awesome.
Oh, I'm so glad. And I mean, it is. It's absolutely ridiculous. If your listeners want to go on my Instagram and see it, it's an absolutely ridiculous video. And a lot of people wrote to me and were like, just laughing and saying, oh my gosh, I want to join your class. And if that's what it does for people, that was exactly the purpose. And you know, and I admit, we made jokes. If you look at the writing too, like, you know, like Ellen, here we come, you know, or like, Sir Twitch-a-Lot and Allison Holker, you are inspirations. And, you know, and we named ourselves. So my friend is Asian American, and we named ourselves the Far East Hotties, or no, the Far. Yeah. And, you know, it's just, we made complete jerks of ourselves, and it's cool. It's fine. 'Cause we had so much fun doing it.
There's so much more we could talk about, but is there anything that I haven't asked about in these themes that you think we should cover?
No, but I don't, I mean, we've talked about it, but I guess I can just reiterate that, because I have, and you've seen it too, right? I mean, I've come a long way. Nothing, this is not easy. It's not easy at all. And, you know, what you see on the surface, I have to remind myself of this all the time, is be appreciative, because you never know what path whomever had to walk to get to where they are. And it is super competitive, and it's hard, but, you know, just, I guess it's so cliche, but try your best, reassess, prioritize, try to have fun. Because there are so many rejections. And I, you know, a girlfriend of mine, reminded me, And I hold her comment, maybe this is a good way to end, very dear to me. She passed away much too young and in her late 30s. But she said to me, she said, and she was the first to go to college. She has a double master's from Columbia in architecture and business, which is just incredible. But she said to me, I will always have so much respect for artists, because I go to an office job and there's always a job for me and I'm always going to get paid and there's a desk for me. But artists have to create something from nothing. And I can't do that. And I don't know how they do that. And I will always have respect for that. And it's this beautiful thing to me because we live in an economy in a country that's very capitalistic. And so much of what we are told to appreciate comes with a dollar value. And if it's not expensive or you're not paid a lot, then you may not get the attention that it deserves. But I think there's a counter narrative there that we should be really conscious of.
Congratulations on all that you've been doing.
Oh, thank you. And I keep up those dance moves. You too, Dan.
You can find Teru Clavel at her website, teruclavel.com, which is TeruClavel. Her book, World Class, One Mother's Journey Halfway Around the Globe in Search of the Best Education for Her Children, is out wherever books are sold. On Twitter and Instagram, she is at Teru Clavel. And on Facebook, she is Teru Clavel Writer. My name again is Dan Blank. You can find me at wegrowmedia.com and on social media at Dan Blank. Thank you so much for listening until the end.